Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Please be seated. In our first case this morning, 2022-1251, in the matter of CZ, on behalf of the appellant, Ms. Kowalski. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Walton.
Good morning, Your Honor. I am actually on behalf of the amicus on this. I represent biological mother Penn H. My co-counsel here represents biological father, the appellant, DC. We are ready to proceed, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Justice, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Michael Walton. As I stated, I represent the biological mother, NH. My colleague at counsel's table, Judith Kowalski, represents the appellant, biological father, DC. Your Honors, before this court today for consideration is the question that when reviewing a trial court's determination to terminate parental rights, what is the appropriate standard of review? Your Honors, I think my colleague who submitted an amicus brief, Mr. Paulus, stated it best in his brief. It depends. Your Honors, the reason it depends is because what we are looking at here is both a quantitative and a qualitative aspect to these appeals. We are looking to the sufficiency of the evidence as well as the manifest weight of the evidence. Accordingly, our position would be that when reviewing a trial court's determination to terminate parental rights, the proper standard that this court should set forth is a two-part analysis that first looks to that sufficiency, applying a de novo standard of review based upon clear and convincing evidence, and then turning to the manifest weight of the evidence. Your Honors, we believe that this is the proper procedure by which to go about these cases for the following reasons. Parental rights are fundamental liberty interest worthy of scrupulous protections. The current discord amongst the appellate districts as it regards this issue is inconsistent with this court's finding in State v. Tompkins and Eastley v. Volkman, as well as some of the members of this bench and decisions that they have made regarding these issues. That is because there is confusion as to sufficiency and weight. We have melded these together rather than keeping them as distinct legal concepts. Therefore, a qualitative and quantitative analysis must be kept independent of one another. Further, neither of those implicate an abuse of discretion standard. Your Honors, it has been well founded that parental rights are an essential and fundamental liberty interest, and a parent's right to the custody and his or her own children has been deemed paramount. The reason I am here today on behalf of the biological mother is because this is such a fundamental liberty interest. We feel that there should be harmony amongst all of the appellate courts as it regards a review of these kind of cases. The way it currently stands, there are about three different standards being used. We have some courts applying manifest weight only. We have other courts looking to a sufficiency of the evidence. And then we have some courts that are just mixing the two together and not really consistent on what analysis they are using.
Would you ever apply abuse of discretion?
Your Honor, if you could clarify, apply it in this type of case?
You said the standard would depend. And so in what situation would abuse of discretion be appropriate?
An abuse of discretion standard would not be appropriate in these matters because when we are looking at the manifest weight of the evidence, we're going to go ahead and do a manifest weight analysis. When we're looking to the sufficiency of the evidence, we would be using a clear and convincing standard. That's the standard that requires proof that produces in the mind of the trier of fact a firm belief or conviction in the outcome or what the evidence has established here.
So what about the determination of the fact? Because the domestic relations judge or the juvenile judge would be the trier of fact in that case. And so when there's an issue of fact and the court has to determine what the facts are, should we leave those undisturbed absent an abuse of discretion?
Your Honor, we believe that we should apply to these type of involuntary termination of parental rights what we do in another realm where we terminate parental rights, and that would be adoptions. We have Holcomb, which states that we do a sufficiency review. So the sufficiency review is available, and the standard that we would use is the burden of proof at the trial court, which is clear and convincing.
Well, how do we tell an appellate court how to review something that really was basically had to be the fact itself had to be determined when there was conflicting evidence? Does that play into clear and convincing, or can we still find some instances where abuse of discretion is appropriate when the Court of Appeals isn't there to actually observe the demeanor of the witnesses?
Your Honor, we're not proposing that we supplant the Court of Appeals with the trier of fact. We would concede that they are in the best position to observe things such as demeanor.
You mean the trial court?
The trial court, yes. Thank they you. Would be in the best position to observe these firsthand aspects of the permanent custody hearings. What we are proposing is that when we are reviewing that, we look to the amount of evidence. Do we have the right amount, the sufficient evidence? And then turn over and look at the qualitative aspect of it. Does it lead us to the manifest weight of the evidence? Is there something where the trial court was led astray? This is not an abuse of discretion standard. But on the other hand, this is something we use in other areas where it implicates fundamental liberty interests. We have State v. Tompkins, we have Eastley v. Volkman. Those cases establish in the criminal context and in the civil context that this two-part analysis is what should be applied.
But doesn't it depend on the claim? Because if there's a statutory standard of review, the court has to look at that. So isn't some of the onus on the parties bringing the action or defending the action, but more so bringing the action, to really state the claim so that it's clearer to any court what standard of review should be applied?
Certainly, Your Honor, and that is why clarification is needed here, because currently what we have is different appellate districts doing different things. If we go to the 8th, it's very unclear what we're doing here. If we go to the 11th, they're telling us that we're going to do an abuse of discretion standard. If we go to the 12th, if we look at Butler County, for example, they're going to say we're going to do this two-part analysis. That impacts many things, including, as Your Honor, you have stated here, what standard of review counsel believes they're going to use, how they're going to advise their clients, whether they're going to advise them to bring an issue up on appeal. That implicates some due process issues, hence why we are asking for clarification here.
Is it going to make any difference in this case?
Your Honors, we would contend that it may make a difference here, that as it regards procedural due process, the results are not determinative of how this court should rule. Rather, it's the process by which how we got there.
Well, let me ask you another way. I mean, could we just do that review here? You know, assuming we think you're correct that sufficiency and manifest weight are the proper standards, any reason we shouldn't just do that review here?
Certainly, Your Honor, you'd be more than able to do that review. The problem that you would then run into is that we would have this repetitive nature of these, where because the appellate courts are in discord.
Well, that wouldn't, you know, we would, obviously, if we did the review here, we would say what the standard review is.
And that, going back and sending it back to the lower courts for that review and for future cases, this is a conflict of laws question that was brought up. So it's not that the facts don't necessarily matter.
But in a conflict of law, are under the statute, under the constitutional provision, we have to decide the case as well. And so my question to you is this going to change the outcome?
Yes, Your Honor, we believe that it would. And I would reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
On behalf of Ashtabula County Children's Services Board. Oh, I thought she was doing rebuttal. So she's just going to argue and then take the remaining time?
And we will reserve
1 minute for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I'm sorry, Ms. Kowalski. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, Your Honors. May it please the court. I am Attorney Judith Kowalski, and I represent the appellant, the biological father, and his name is D.C. Why does the standard of appellate review in parental rights termination cases matter? It matters because the vast majority of the parents in these cases are poor, very often at a disadvantage when opposed by the state. And again, discussing the standard of review that is proposed here today, I want to reiterate what my co-counsel discussed in terms of the sufficiency argument. When we're looking at the adoption cases, adoption has a standard of proof of clear and convincing evidence, and the standard of review is sufficiency. But in an adoption case, you have private parties who are roughly equal in standing. In parental termination cases, permanent custody cases, it is the state versus the parent. So there's an inequity there. As outlined in the Santosky case, the state has the advantage in these cases. And as indicated in Santosky, I would note ominously, when a child is in agency custody, the state has the power to shape the historical events that form the basis for termination. So these are cases that involve rights so in need of scrupulous protection that the burden of proof is clear and convincing evidence. And so
let me go back to the question I was asking. Counsel. So assume we agree with you. Is that going to change the outcome of this case?
It would, because in this particular case, this father had not been given a case plan to work. This father had, the only thing that he was asked to do was to contact the worker about visitation, which he did do. This was also a case.
Didn't the father decline to participate in the case plan?
He did not. He was told to contact the worker to set up a meeting, and that is what he did. He did contact the worker. This is also a case in which there were three other children. There were a total of four of my client's children in this case, each in separate placements, three of them in legal custody of relatives, and ZC was being treated differently. And it was never explained as to why there was a necessity for that to happen. And in fact, there was evidence indicated that it was an issue for the children that they were separated and that there was concern about not being able to communicate with ZC, which is another reason why this is such a drastic issue, because these are cases that not only impact parents, these are cases that impact siblings and other relatives.
But there were a total of eight children, correct?
There were eight children. Four of them were my client's children. Four of them involved in this case.
Correct, but all of the eight children had lived together, so it's kind of hard to cordon off just four kids when you've got eight kids who live together, correct?
Yes, and in this case, four of the children were not my client's children. They had all lived together. They were all the same mother. But this case concerned the four that were his, and three of them went legal custody, and then this child went permanent custody. And that is another issue that often comes up at the trial level, is what is the state requesting? The state could request a less restrictive disposition for these children, even when they are in foster care. They can, if the foster parents are willing and the state is willing, to do legal custody, which does not grant the parents custody, but allows them to retain their parental rights. But if the state doesn't ask for it, and a party doesn't try to intervene and ask for it, then the court is constrained to rule on whether permanent custody or not. You might legitimately have a case where a parent isn't ready or available to take custody, but does that equate with the permanency and never being able to see the child again and the child never being able to see the parent again? So this is a case where the state has a lot of power to determine what's going to happen, and they are, again, as indicated very dramatically in the Santosky opinion, they are the ones who can present, who can organize, they have the better resources, and they can have a second bite at the apple. If they lose at the trial level, they can come back and they can go for permanent custody again. And finally, I would say that because these are the most precious rights that we have, some would say that for many parents, the right to love and care for one's children is more precious than life itself. Permanent custody has drastic and irreversible impact on those involved. So when it becomes necessary for the state to step in, we must ensure those rights have been scrupulously protected, and the standard of review as outlined in our brief and the briefs of the Amici from Case Western Reserve and Mr. Walton, we believe that that standard will protect those rights.
I'm still struggling with why, if we adopt your standard of review, you'll be successful, or that we should remand. Why shouldn't we just decide here? Even the dissenting judge applying the standard of review, different standard of review, found that permanent custody should be filed, should not have permanent custody.
Well, again, Your Honor, I it didn't.
I mean, just point me to some facts that would be helpful.
Again, I think the father was not given the opportunity to work the case plan. The children were all in separate placements, and
but you're not going to be able to relitigate the trial court's factual findings, though.
We would be successful. Although I continue to believe that we would be. The point is to make it fundamentally fair, a fair standard. A fair standard for my client, a fair standard for the mother, a fair standard for all the parents, and not this disparate and confusing application throughout the state of Ohio where you get different results for different families, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. On behalf of Ashtabula County Children's Services Board, Ms. O'Toole.
Madam Justice, and may it please the court, it is both an honor and privilege to argue before you today, and I have brought with me Ashtabula County APA Christopher Fortunato on behalf of the Ashtabula County Children's Services Board. We are here on a conflict from the 11th District Court of Appeals, and we're requesting that this court affirm the findings as well as the reasoning of the 11th District. We have also requested this court to Justice DeWine's questions to enter judgment even if you do decide to enter a different standard of review. And because we do not feel that under any standard of review, the facts in this case would support a different result. And because this is permanent custody and because these children are languishing, and that's the whole thing about this. The parents' rights are really important, but the child's right to be safe in one's home, the child's right to have parents that will take care of them and ensure their education and all the other things that come before you, sometimes get short shift in this permanent custody discussion. I think it is very, very clear that all the cases certified for conflict by the 11th Appellate District, that there is a need for clarification for the standard. My clients feel the standard is consistent in the 11th Appellate District. There is some discrepancy, however, when I was reviewing the case law in regard to what exactly is an abuse of discretion. It would be nice if some of that was clarified. The 11th Appellate District is very short.
Isn't that the point? I mean, how can you apply an abusive discretion standard to what is essentially a factual determination, how much evidence there is? How would someone even go about doing that?
Abuse of discretion standard?
Right.
Well, I think the underlying statute is kind of
how can a judge abuse his discretion in determining whether or not the state has put forth each element that needs to establish.
So is your question indicating that it's so broad that it's almost impossible?
Typically we apply abuse of discretion standards to decisions where judges have some discretion. right? If a evidentiary rule allows judges' discretion to do things, then we say, has he abused this discretion, or has she abused this discretion?
Mm-hmm.
How do you apply that standard to what is essentially an evidentiary determination?
Well, the interesting about the standard is it's from the position of the appellate court. So when you look at it, the issue is did the trial court err, in effect? And how much oversight does the appellate court wish to exercise in regard to?
So it's just like how big was their error? That's what the standard does?
Well, it not only how big was the error, but how much does this court or the appellate court want to be that 13th juror, right? Do we want to be second-guessing as the prosecutor's office advocate?
That sounds like manifest weight.
It is both. So when, at least the way I have reviewed it, one, it's very confusing between the appellate case law as well as the briefing here. We have sufficiency and manifest weight, and normally the standard of review is reserved for evidence-based admissions. My position here, or our position here, is that we need a clear standard that doesn't mimic an evidentiary standard. It has to be determined to be separate as far as the judgment or discretion allowed to the trial court from the position of an appellate bench.
Well, but isn't that exactly what manifest weight does?
Well, I think I think all judgments, in order to be adequate, the trial judges have to consider manifest weight, right? When they're looking at whether or not there's enough evidence there, they're doing that weighing exercise firsthand, front and center. The role of the appellate.
Then what does, if you think that the judge does do manifest weight, then what does abuse of discretion add to it?
The abuse of discretion would add to us, or the appellate court, looking at Did they abuse their discretion? Was the manifest weighing exercise sufficient?
So let me follow up, because in this case, the 11th District found that the trial court did not abuse its discretion when it adopted the magistrate's order recommending permanency. So the actual fact finding occurred by a magistrate, and essentially, the 11th District, number one, said, applied the abuse of discretion to whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in adopting the magistrate's decision. So there's like a couple layers there before it ever gets to the Court of Appeals. And second of all, on clear and convincing evidence, the appellate court said that there's ample competent and credible evidence to support the trial court's finding of clear and convincing evidence. Isn't that something de novo that the Court of Appeals can do? Okay. So can you help us with where should the abuse of discretion be applied? Is it just in how the court adopts a magistrate's decision, or the court's actual factual findings? And number two, that if we bump it up to clear and convincing, which is actually an evidentiary standard and not a standard of review.
That's right.
That's something the court can look at de novo at the appellate level, correct?
I generally divide it into evidence-based determinations. Fact-finding by the court has generally and throughout the law been an issue for an abuse of discretion. Like what comes in, what doesn't? How much weight to give a particular piece of evidence in coming up with the trial court's decision. Issues correctly briefed, I think, are if it's an issue of law, right? Clearly it must be de novo. We can't have things, and it would also be, for that matter, an abuse of discretion, right? Because it would go right under that umbrella, right? You can't have use the wrong law and just get away with it because you have a different standard of review, right? It's got to be the correct law as applied. So this almost a mixed standard of review, where you look at certain aspects of the judgment, particularly giving big credence to findings of fact and coming up with what lays out the facts. Almost like what I think of is sometimes I look at the mixed standard review on a motion to suppress, where we defer all the fact-finding to the trial court because they're there. They're hearing the testimony. They're getting all that. And then did they apply the law to the facts appropriately? And that's what I'm what I think when I think of a standard of review. And there are several standards of review here, and it's really going to be up to this court because there is so much confusion. When I read these, I'm like, I mean, one opinion I think used all three standards in there, trying to figure out what it is. And I don't think we can look at these cases necessarily in a vacuum. So when all these cases are horrible cases, they don't get to the point of permanent custody unless they have already been pretty much involved from the initial abuse, neglect, and dependency finding. So under the abuse and dependency finding,
what do you mean by
353?
What do you mean by horrible cases? Are you talking about the
it's
cases?
It's never great when people have their children taken.
Okay. I didn't know if you meant the various cases where there was a conflict or.
Oh, no, just... no. I'm saying from the human perspective, right? We've been doing this neglect, abuse, and dependency law for a lot of years. So what happens is upon the finding of the neglect, abuse, and dependency, the clock starts to tick. And the goal of the entire statute and this entire statutory scheme here is to remedy the reasons why the children came into the system, to basically wrap the family around in a multidisciplinary team during the temporary custody period of, you know, the 12 of 22 months. And so what happens is we throw everything at them, we give them as much as we can to see if they can remedy or make the children or come up to the plate, so to speak, so that the children will have a safe and stable and permanent home. Once you have doctors, you have psychologists, you have lawyers, these folks have multiple hearings. So there's six-month hearings every 6 months, they have social worker visits, they have guardian ad litem visits. There's a multidisciplinary team trying to help and remedy this family to work them through the crisis. And at some point, once you have an adjudication on the neglect, abuse, and dependency, then the 12 of 22 months starts to tick. And the reason why it starts to tick is because we had huge problems with foster care drift early on. And so at that point, when you're to the permanent custody filing, almost everything has been exhausted. And the key there is do the parents have it or don't they?
What is foster care drift?
Oh, well, originally what would happen is kids would be put into this temporary custody position where they were taken from the parents, and it would go on for years. And the kids would never get adopted, and there wasn't any permanency originally. Actually, it was my first job as a public defender, so I've been doing this law for about 40 years. So by the time they get here, they've had hearings. Everybody who walks into the permanent custody hearing on that day, everybody's got an opinion. Everybody's reviewed the documents. They have been working with this family for months. So by the time we get here, you either have, they can't make it. They've tried and they just can't get to the point where they can keep the kids safe, or the agency somehow has fallen down on the job and not given them the requisite visits, or there's something going on, right? So this is not their first review. So I think, at that point, the question is what is the opinion of the multidisciplinary team, which I use as the legal system that we've wrapped around this case? It's social work versus law, right? And they collide right here at the issue of permanent custody. And so when you're looking at abuse of discretion standard, the judge is in the best position to make these calls.
What if the judge didn't even hear the case and just read the transcript from the magistrate, or maybe just read the magistrate's report?
Well, he could have done that, but usually what happens is they've already been through the system even earlier. So this is not their first time through. They've already had an adjudication and a full trial on the reasons for removal and what needs to be done.
But how can we assume that?
Well, from the cases that I'm looking at here, the ones that were in conflict are the ones I looked at. So the ones that we cited as conflict.
So that's another question. Not all these cases were on all fours or even, you know, the same situation. I mean, we can't issue an advisory opinion. So how do we provide guidance to the courts, and how would you limit the scope of our decision?
Well, I think we're back to Justice DeWine's question, right? Can you correct the standard of review and yet affirm the findings of the Court of Appeals? Not necessarily maybe the reasoning of the Court of Appeals. Let's say you decide differently in a mixed standard of review. You can still enter judgment on behalf of the agency in this case, even though the reasoning was incorrect.
Because Judge Trapp would have, she concurred in judgment only, but she had a difference on the standard of review, which was actually not the way you'd like to go.
Right, that is correct. It is not the way I'd like to go. I mean, for purposes of my brief, I'm looking at a complete abuse of discretion standard.
Why not is that the way you don't want to go? If the standard's clear and convincing at the trial court, why shouldn't it be a sufficiency review?
Because I would really like the language to be clearer for purposes of interpretation. So
wouldn't that be clearer than a nebulous abuse of discretion?
Well, but at least that's a standard. That's a recognized standard of review. So as I outlined in my brief, this issue of standard of review is very well developed in the federal case law. But as far as like a clear standard of review, we have all kinds of standards of review here. So clear and convincing is an evidence. Primarily, people know it as an evidence standard, a burden standard, right? And so what's happened is everybody's conflating them. So some of it is for clarification purposes and for clarity of evaluation and analysis, especially at the appellate level.
Isn't it very straightforward to say that the evidentiary standard in the trial court is clear and convincing, and the appellate court is going to review that to see if the evidence is sufficient and if it's against the manifest weight of the evidence? That seems very clear and in line what we do in other contexts.
That is true. There are other areas that you have had held in that area. I'm just saying that the fact is it seems to be very confusing presently. And people are using it, and it's still not clear. And so when I'm looking
But wouldn't adopting the father's position on the standard of review bring the clarity you're looking for?
I think the clear and convincing evidence standard and or now a standard of review is what the trial court needs to bring forward, right? That's their finding. That's statutory. Sure. The legislature does not give us a standard of review here, so it'll be up to the decision of this court to determine what the appellate standard of review is. I think if you're using the same standard of review that the trial court is using, you are in essence using a de novo standard of review.
Well, wouldn't, as far as the sufficiency part, it would be de novo. That's always
right, because sufficiency is a matter of law, right? Sufficiency is a matter of law.
And for the weight, you're valuing the manifest weight. That's
right. And manifest weight would traditionally be a issue for the trial court, not an appellate court, except in rare circumstances.
That's certainly not true. I mean, we review every appellate court factual criminal case is reviewed for manifest weight of the evidence by the appellate court.
Yes, that is correct. But I don't know if that's, I mean, again, I don't know if that's, I mean, yes, it is a standard of review. And also the issue is manifest weight is also included in the Ohio Constitution, as you're aware, and it's the standard by which an appellate court cannot reverse unless you have three judges on the appellate court. So there's a special carve out in Ohio for manifest weight.
But wouldn't that give you the same protection that abuse of discretion does?
Protection for?
Well, if abuse of discretion is pretty hard to actually find.
That's correct. There's a lot of deference there. Like, I mean, it's hard from an appellate bench. It depends on how strict you want to have oversight, right? The question is how much oversight do we need in the family law equivalent of the death penalty by the appellate court?
Sure, and a sufficiency is fair because it's really an evidentiary question. But when you get to manifest weight, the court sits as a 13th juror, and they all have to be unanimous in their decisions. So I think that might actually provide more.
If it's done at trial, not necessarily in this particular instance.
But it would have to, I think it would end up providing a little more deference to the trial judge than abuse of discretion may, because as you said, abuse of discretion is rather nebulous.
It clearly is. And it's also hard from this court's perspective or from an appellate court's perspective to clean up kind of bad things that happen down there. You know what I mean? If the judge is not doing something as an appellate practitioner and in my former career, I see that there. However, the statute is so mushy with so much discretion involved that I don't know if it'll actually make a difference. You know what I mean? As far, all the cases that are mentioned here would go the same way regardless of the standard we used when I'm looking at the evidence and reviewing the records. I don't think it would change whether we're using the de novo standard, the clear and convincing standard, or the abuse of discretion standard. I think by the time you get to that point, that those cases are usually pretty baked in. So, thank you.
Thank you. I'll give you a minute, Mr. Walton, to respond.
May it please the court. Justice DeWine, not only do we use this in other areas of the law, we use this in cases like in In Re CH, where you found the sufficiency standard is the standard in the evaluation that we should be undertaking. Practically speaking, Your Honors, what we're asking for here is not for something that is outcome determinative or to change this. We are asking for fundamental fairness. I've represented NH since 2019 when this case came out. What I'm asking for is that NH have the same level of due process that in Ashtabula as my clients in Akron, as my clients in Cuyahoga County, and then my clients in Allen County may have. Currently, we do not have that. Each appellate district is different. Therefore, fundamental due process is not being given to our clients. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court.